I thought I would just try to take a moment to tell you who we are, Jim. You are speaking to the international headquarters staff of the Navigators, and you've met some of our gang on your travels. So those of you who are in the international office, some part of it, stand up so Jim can know who he's talking to. That's to start with. Then we have a separate crew that runs Glen Erie, this property here, Jim, and would those people stand on the Glen Erie crew? Okay, and then thank you. Then we have some Christian friends, some from town, some visiting from out of state here at the Glen, Jim. So we're eager to hear from you about your personal experience with Christ. Also, we're eager to hear about some of your experiences on your travels around the world in recent months. the slow type travel. And then also, of course, we're interested to hear about high flight and anything you'd like to tell us about that, and to introduce your sidekick to us also. Jim, thanks for coming to be with us.
It is good to be with you this morning. We're sorry we're a little late. We were so engrossed with enjoying the beauty out here at Glen Erie that we just drove very slowly through the grounds. I would like to introduce Rocky Farché, who is with me, who works with me in this High Flight Foundation. Rocky, why don't you stand so they can see you? We're overwhelmed by numbers this morning. Rocky has to do the job of probably 5 or 10 people down there at High Flight. Well, I can understand why you all look so happy this morning, because you have such a beautiful place to work. It must be a great inspiration to be able to work in such beautiful surroundings. I guess a lot of you are wondering, you know, why would an astronaut be here talking to you this morning? But I must say that, you know, we could not do our job without a cast of thousands behind us. We needed navigators on our space mission, and of course we need navigators in the life we live here on the Earth. And so I'm just here sharing with you, really, as a man who's had the unique opportunity, you know, to move out in space, go all the way to the moon and come back to the Earth. But coming back really a new man, one who really deeply believes, you know, in the Christian teachings of my youth. And I must say I strayed a few times, didn't fully appreciate what I was being taught in those years. You know, I tell people that since I got back that I'm a new man in Jesus Christ, and people, you know, wonder about that. I say, well, weren't you religious before you went to the moon? And it's a hard question to answer, as many of you know, and I tell them, well, I was a Christian. I called myself a Christian, but I wasn't a witnessing Christian. I didn't have anything, you know, inside that I really wanted to share with people. And so I wasn't really an active Christian the way I should have been. And, of course, the flight changed that, changed all of it. Of course, I should tell you that I did accept Jesus Christ, you know, as a young man, 11 years old, and in a little church down in Newport Richey, Florida. But I'd been to so many churches throughout my life. You know, as a young man, I went to the Lutheran Church, Pennsylvania. Then we moved to Florida, went to the Methodist Church, asked Jesus Christ to be my personal Lord and Savior during a revival service in the little Baptist church. But continued going to the Methodist Church, moved over to Orlando, joined the Presbyterian Church, been a Presbyterian most of my life, although when we lived in Salt Lake City, I went to the Mormon Church. So I've had exposure to many different churches, and of course it wasn't until just before the flight that I joined the Baptist Church. But maybe that's why, you know, always searching, always trying to look for this right relationship with God and Jesus Christ. And consequently, I had many ups and downs, many hills and valleys in this religious life. And I always share with people, you know, the very deepest valley that I passed through occurred, you know, many, many years after that night of dedication. It occurred when I was out at Edwards Air Force Base. And I guess the depth of the valley seemed so much deeper because I just achieved a mountaintop experience. Because after many, many years of trying, I was finally successful in going to our test pilot school, the Air Force Test Pilot School. I graduated, and then I had the greatest of all opportunities. That was to be assigned as the first and only test pilot on the world's highest and fastest flying airplane, the YF-12A. Why couldn't have asked for a greater opportunity as a young test pilot? And so really I was living on top of a mountaintop on cloud nine. And here when I thought I was right on top of the world, I went out early one Sunday morning in a light airplane, instructing a student, and we crashed out there in the desert. I don't know what happened to the airplane, but the student was at the controls, of course, and we'd just taken off. We were turning on crosswind when the plane went into an uncontrollable flat spin, and we just crashed out there in the desert just south of the main base. It was a horrible accident in which, you know, both of us received many serious injuries. I'd received two broken legs, a broken jaw, a concussion, many, many cuts and bruises. Fortunately, the plane did not burn, and so they were able to pull our bodies out of the wreckage. I had amnesia for 24 hours. The doctors actually considered amputating my right foot. And I can recall so well that my first thought as I, you know, gained consciousness, I was able to think for myself as I was there in the hospital, I asked, Lord, why? Lord, why did you let this happen to me? You know, you'd raise me up to the very top, and here you let me fall so low. Why, Lord? Why? As I lay there in that hospital bed, I prayed to God harder than I ever had before, praying for understanding and for recovery. And God answered those prayers because, first of all, I came to realize that I was rushing through life too fast, you know, not fully appreciating the daily blessings that were mine. He answered the prayers for recovery because in just 2 months I was able to leave the hospital. At this point, I had a cast on each leg. My jaw was still wired up, and I was on crutches. But at least I was moving out of the hospital on my own power, and as many of you know, that's a vital step in anyone's recovery. 2 more months, my wounds had completely healed to the point where I knew I was ready to fly again. But then I was in for a very bitter blow because the Air Force said, no, Captain Irwin, you're a pilot, you've had a concussion, well, you've even had amnesia. We can't possibly let you fly for at least a year while we completely evaluate you to decide, you know, whether you're really capable of flying again. So this was a hard one to accept, one that required a lot more prayer for understanding. But finally, after 14 months, my prayers were answered. Once again on flying status and able to soar through the sky. I've always loved the high places because I've always felt closer to God on the high places of the earth or in the sky. Well, you know, this love for flying and the high place just naturally led me to try to become an astronaut, to try to go even higher. But believe me, it wasn't an easy job to convince our space administration that Jim Irwin should become an astronaut. Why should a man who's had a very serious accident, who's had so many ups and downs, why should he become an astronaut? And so I began this task of trying to convince the space administration. In the first attempt, I did get as far as the final selections down in Houston, but I was turned down, probably because of that recent accident. I tried the next year, but they were looking for young men with doctor's degrees, so again I was turned down. Then on the third attempt, at a time when we were actually living here in Colorado Springs, and I was working over at Air Defense Command Headquarters, I tried, but I didn't think I had any chance in the world. One of the factors against me was I was right at the age limit for the astronaut program. But I tried, and as the Lord would have it, why, they accepted me. And, of course, we moved from here, moved down to Houston, Texas, where we'd lived for the last 6 years until just this last summer when I retired from the Air Force and the space program to move back to the mountains of Colorado. But when we report in as, you know, new astronauts, we're considered as rookies. In fact, we're rookies for many, many years as we begin to learn the things that we must know before they allow us to go into space. We're taught many new subjects, subjects that are rather strange to men who've been fighter pilots, test pilots most of their lives, subjects such as orbital mechanics and the study of the solar system, astronomy, and the study of rocks. That was really a new one, geology. After we receive this very basic instruction, why then they give us jobs of responsibility, of authority, as we gain experience by actually working with the spacecraft. I served as a support crewman for Apollo 10 and backup for Apollo 12, and then finally my big opportunity as a prime crewman for Apollo 15. Well, I think that you here certainly understand the need for preparation. And I always view that preparation for an astronaut, for a man to go into space, for a man anywhere, really, on the earth, in three distinct areas, and that's a preparation of body, mind, and spirit. And my daily prayer was that God would guide me in my preparations for that flight. And he did guide me. Guided me right up to the, right through that flight. But let me just insert here just one brief visit we had to the Air Force Academy, because it was so meaningful in the total picture. You know, as the first all-Air Force crew, we particularly wanted to share with the cadets at the Academy so that they would understand, you know, what we're going to try to accomplish on our mission. As we toured the campus there, we were impressed with the beauty. Certainly not as beautiful as Glen Eyrie, but beautiful in its own way, the statues and the buildings. But there was that one particular statue that really caught our eye, and that was the eagle and eaglets just outside Mitchell Hall. Because of those words that all of you probably know very well, the words that are inscribed on it, that man's flight through life is sustained by the power of his knowledge. Well, just immediately, those words, just they reached out and they grabbed us. They moved us. They captivated our imagination to the point where we immediately decided that we'd make those words the motto of Apollo 15. Actually decided we'd put them on our flight medallions, which we carried with us to the moon. But that's rare, you know, to have three people move the same way at the same time, particularly three astronauts, because we're such individualists. But let me share those words with you again, because they're so meaningful to me, and I think meaningful to the age in which we all live, that man's flight through life is sustained by the power of his knowledge, underlining his, capitalizing his, because it's truly the knowledge of Jesus Christ which lifts us all up, which sustains us, which strengthens us as we live our lives on this earth. Well, in the summer of 71, our personal preparations were complete, and we were told that the spacecraft was ready for us. And I recall so well when Deke came in early that morning. He said, "All right, you guys, it's time to get up. Are you ready to go to the moon?" And of course, we groggily said we were. He took us into the little mess hall we have there, and they fed us a big breakfast. I had a steak for breakfast. They wanted us to be well nourished for that flight to the moon. Then they took us into the suit room, and they stuffed us into our spacesuits. Then they attached the gloves and the helmet. And then they tested the security of that suit. You know, made sure it was absolutely airtight, because, of course, we were going to be completely dependent on that suit for many, many hours in space. Once everyone was assured we had a good suit, then they took us down from that suit room, placed us in a mobile van, and drove us out to the launch pad. When we got out of the mobile van there on the launch pad, we had a brief opportunity to look up and see that tremendous structure, that booster and spacecraft on which we were going to be riding. And it was just a beautiful sight in that early morning sun. But then very briefly, they took us into the elevator, and then they took us all the way up, you know, to that very upper level, about 360 feet high. And then they took us across the swing arm, which was a very narrow walkway that's practically open on the sides, so that you can look down from that great distance and see a few people down there about the size of ants. But then very quickly, you're in the white room, which surrounds the command module. And then they begin this operation referred to as crew insertion. And that's just what it is. You know, they insert the crew. They put the crew into the command module. And they almost need a shoehorn to do that, because we're so bulky in those big suits. And so they just ease us, guide our bodies, really, into the couch. Of course, we have two suit technicians in the command module assisting us. And they're very careful as they put us in there that we don't hit any switch or circuit breaker. After they get us onto the couch in the proper position, then they attach the umbilicals to the suit. They attach our seat belt for us, and of course they attach the shoulder harness, and they pull it down very tight because they want us tied to that couch for the accelerations of launch. After they get the three of us in position, they just pat us on the shoulder and they get out. And then they close that big steel hatch. You know, it kind of clangs like a dungeon door. And you realize that at that moment it hits you that it's no longer a simulation, that they're really serious. They're really going to launch you. But unfortunately, they don't launch you right away. You know, they make you lie there for a few more hours waiting and wondering. And it's a period of time when there's not much for the crew to do, because that pre-launch sequence is almost completely automatic. So it is a period of time where you reflect many times on your life and wondering just what got you into this position. I frequently get the question, well, Jim, were you ever frightened on the flight? And I always say, no, astronauts are never frightened. But then I'm quick to add that during that period of time, there was a little concern, a little anxiety, an air of anticipation, an air of expectancy as we awaited that moment of liftoff. And so the time was just dragging by. And then, but that last minute went very fast. Before we knew it, we heard the word ignition. And then we sensed, then we felt, and we heard. All that tremendous power was being released underneath that missile. It was beginning to lift us off the earth. And there was a moment there just of supreme elation. Almost the happiest moment of my life. A complete release of tensions. To realize that after all of these years of preparation and training, indeed it was my turn. At last I was leaving the earth. Held our breath there for a few more seconds until we heard the next words of tower clear. Because at that point we knew that we were off the earth, we were free of the tower, and we were on a clear, purposeful voyage to the moon. A voyage in which there might be problems, but one in which we knew that we were thoroughly prepared. We had equipment that we had complete confidence in. We knew that we had the best brains available all over the earth to work with us if a problem should come up. But most importantly, we knew that we had the prayers of all mankind. Well, we saw many beautiful views on that flight to the moon. But by far the most beautiful view that we had was that view of the earth. You know, when we could first see it as a ball in the sky. Because believe me, it's a unique planet we live on. A warm, beautiful, living spaceship. This one we call Earth. And when we could first see it as a ball in the sky, it was about the size of a basketball. And it was such a gorgeous view. You know, because it was a full Earth. There were fully illuminated, and yet you could clearly see the details of the land masses, because there was North and South America, Europe and Africa. And you could see the colors of the earth, the tans of the deserts, and the blues and the greens of the oceans of the earth, and the whites of just a few clouds that were on the earth. And it really did remind us of a very beautiful, but a very, very fragile Christmas tree ornament hanging there in the blackness of space. And then to see that spaceship Earth, our home Earth, you know, diminish in size, get ever smaller as we got farther and farther away. To say it shrank from the size of a basketball down to the size of a baseball, to the size of a golf ball, and then finally to the size of a marble out in space, really has to change a man. Has to make a man appreciate everything that we have here on this earth. Has to make a man appreciate the creation of God, the love of God, and the gift of God. Well, we had so many beautiful things to see during that flight that it didn't take long before we were actually on the surface of the moon at Hadley Base. Dave and I couldn't have asked for a more beautiful spot on the surface of the moon to spend 3 days. It truly was beautiful because we had the high Apennine Mountains, mountains that were 15,000 feet high on three sides of us, and then a deep canyon of Hadley Rill to the west. We felt right at home in the mountains of the moon. The point where we've compared it many times to a little valley in the high mountains of the Rockies, you know, above the timberline. And the mountains were golden brown in the early morning sun. And of course, we had an early morning sun coming in the 3 days we were there. So it was a beautiful place to be. Felt very much at home. In fact, it was difficult to convince ourselves we were really on the moon. And the only way we could do that was to look directly overhead, and there was the earth. And at that time, it was a half-earth. About the size of a marble, directly overhead. Of course, that's a convincer, I'll believe me. So we had this beauty, yet we had excitement. The excitement of riding on that lunar dune buggy as we looked for rocks. The excitement of exploring a place on the moon where man had never been before. But the thing that was the most exciting, the thing that really touched my soul and changed my life, was the fact that I could feel God's presence there. Feel Him so close and feel Him in so many different ways. Some of the examples of that presence was the answer to prayer. The fact that we encountered new and difficult tasks that we had to perform. Things that we never considered during all those years of preparation on the earth. And when these very difficult situations came up, I just gave a quick silent prayer to God, and just immediately the answer was there. Then there was the guidance that God provided to us during our exploration. Such as the discovery of the Genesis rock. The very oldest rock. The oldest rock that's ever been found in the universe. You know, before the flight, the scientists, the geologists, had told us that they suspected that the mountains of the moon were made from a white type of rock. But never in our wildest imaginations do we ever dream that we'd find it presented to us in such an unusual way. Because there at the base of Mount Hadley Delta, on the rim of a small crater, and on a pedestal rock that looked like an outstretched palm and was covered very heavily with dust, we found that white Genesis rock, almost free from dust, sitting there, literally lifted up, so all we had to do was reach down and grab it. But literally seeming to say, you know, here am I, take me. It was a very moving experience. Then it was the inspiration of God to cause me to quote from the Scriptures, something which I'd never done before. But it caused me to quote the first verse from Psalm 121, "I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help." Yes, I felt God's presence very close on the moon, to the point, you know, there was some mixed emotion when it became time to leave. But as all of you know, we left right on time. In fact, it kind of caught us by surprise. You know, one moment we were sitting on the moon, the next moment we knew we were 100 feet in space, looking down at where we'd spent 3 days. But now we're back on the earth to a new way of life, really. You know, sharing the experiences of that trip. Telling everyone around the earth, not only the things that we, you know, saw with our eyes, but the things that we felt down deep inside, the things that we felt in our heart. And of course, this is quite a change in lifestyle for me. Because before the flight, frankly, I considered myself as a technician, a test pilot, an operator of a spacecraft, really a nuts and bolts type. You know, one who was so busy learning a task of going from the earth to the moon, I had very little time to think about the needs and the feelings of men and women, boys and girls on the earth. But as we reached out in a very physical way to explore the heavens, I believe that God has touched our lives in a very spiritual way, bringing us back as new men. Where I feel as a humanitarian, you know, one who feels a deep love for all men and women, boys and girls, but then a deep compulsion, a deep desire to share not only the experience, but to share my faith in God and Jesus Christ with everyone on the earth. Because I feel so strongly that Jesus Christ is the only way, the only answer to solve the problems that we face on the earth. And of course, as most of you know, I travel most of the time trying to share with just as many people as I possibly can, you know, spending about 50% of my time overseas, meeting many navigators. In fact, I didn't know there were so many navigators around the earth long. But almost every country I've visited, you know, at the end of the service, why they came up and introduced themselves. And then they always say that they were there. They were praying for me as I spoke. And so it's been a great uplift to me. Because all of you, we're working together. We're trying to reach everyone to change their life, to introduce them to Jesus Christ. I know I've recently used an example of rocks as I share with people around the earth, because many people like to see something, you know, they can see rather than something you're just talking about. And I guess I've been referred to as a man of rocks. Because I hope it's because I brought so many back from the moon. But let me share some of these rocks with you this morning. This first rock, it's a very smooth black rock. It's called a worry stone, a worry rock. And I was given this by an army chaplain down in Panama last summer. I don't know, perhaps I looked very worried. But he gave this to me. He said, "Jim, why don't you take this rock? Maybe you can use it someday." So I took it and he told me the story. He'd actually got this rock over in Korea. But the story goes, you know, if there's any discontent, any uneasiness, any worries in your life, if you'd just be fortunate enough as to have one of these worry rocks in your pocket or maybe your purse, and you could just feel this rock for a few moments, you know, run your fingers over its very smooth texture, that these worries would go away, that life would be made easy. And so I use this rock to represent man's superstition. The next rock I wish to share with you is this moon rock. It's the Genesis rock, the oldest rock that's been found in the universe. But then I must quickly tell you that it's a man-made moon rock. Otherwise, I couldn't carry it in my pocket. I'd need a Marine guard. Not that I'm opposed to the Marines following me around, but it makes it rather difficult in travel. But this rock, you know, represents what man can make. The genius of man. The creativity of man. The level of knowledge that man has attained. And as we all know, you know, man can create so many things. Really, he can make anything he makes his mind up to. It's a very materialistic world in which we live. One where man has made so many things that kind of distract us, to sidetrack us from the things that are most important, the spiritual nature of man. And there's so much competition for time, talent, and thoughts. But so very, very important that we make that right decision, that right choice. And so I use this rock to represent the things that man can make. Materialism. You know, indeed, that man knows so much about the earth, and now he knows so much about the moon that he can make moon rocks. Man is very ingenious, very smart. Then I wish to share this rock with you. This rock, the Word of God. This rock of Jesus Christ. And then I ask you the question, which rock are you going to choose? Which rock are you going to worship? Which rock are you going to depend on to raise your spirits? Which rock offers you a plan not only for your mortal lives, but your life eternal? Would you choose this rock of superstition? Would you choose a rock that man can make, materialism, a thing that man can easily lose? Or will you choose this rock of Jesus Christ, this everlasting rock, this rock that lives forever, this rock that man can never lose, because it lives within the spirit of man? Lauren, I appreciate the opportunity of being with you and with the Nabs here at Glen Eyrie. It's been a great experience for me to be able to share with them. I wish I had the opportunity, and perhaps it will be, to answer some questions about the many travels we've had, because they've been just the greatest opportunities you could have ever asked for, to be able to, so many doors have opened, you know, to be able to talk to the very lowly peasant, to the very head of state, and share, you know, a Christian message with them. To tell them about the inspiration that I felt on the moon. To be able to tell people everywhere on the earth, you know, that God is alive. Not only on the earth, but on the moon. And that God answers prayer throughout the universe. And it's been, people, you know, many times ask me, well, Jim, don't you feel let down? What can you possibly do to equal a trip to the moon? And I tell them that this time since I've been back on the earth has been the most rewarding, most heartwarming experience of my life, to be able to share Jesus Christ with everyone on the earth. Great opportunity, great responsibility, and I need all your prayers. And I look forward to studying my memory verses. But I do want to leave a picture for you, for all of you. This is our Glen Eyrie on the moon. A picture of Hadley Base. I haven't had an opportunity to inscribe it yet, but I will to the navigators. I always refer to it as the best picture that was ever taken on the moon. Of course, I always say that because I'm in it. But, you know, Colonel Dave Scott took this picture, and he's also in it. Shown here because he's reflected in my gold visor. Of course, that opportunity to plant our flag up there to last maybe a billion years had to be one of the proudest moments of my life. You see some of the equipment that man has been smart enough to design and build. Our lunar module Falcon, which served as our camper for 3 days. Our lunar dune buggy here, Rover 1, which served as our transportation system. Great little car. You know, we just barely broke it in. We put 20 miles on it and left it on a used car lot up there. For the next moon explorer that might visit Hadley Base. In the foreground here, you can clearly see some of the footprints of another human being. In the background is Mount Hadley Delta. That mountain is really 13,000 feet high from the base to the top. In other words, with a vertical relief about twice that of Pike's Peak. At the base of that mountain is where we found this Genesis rock. And so you see in this picture some of the things that man has been able to make, but then the beauty of another planet that God has made. And so this picture, I think, tells a great story of what man has been able to do, you know, through training, talent, and in dedication, to have been able to lift man up and physically place them out on the moon, or sent them out into space to bring back knowledge, which we hope will benefit all mankind. We hope that from this knowledge will come understanding and wisdom on how to use that knowledge. But of course, the greater task facing all of us is how we can use those same capabilities, the training, the talent, and dedication of people, to reach out and share with everyone on the earth, trying to tell them that God is alive, that there's a spirit to man that must be inspired. We want to raise all men up so that they can all be inspired to a high point. You know, really, what I wish, you know, that all men and women, boys and girls, could make that trip just for a brief moment to feel some of the inspiration that I felt from that flight. But I know that's not possible, so I try to tell them, try to share with as many as I can, to try to lift them up so that they'll not only feel the inspiration I felt from space, but to feel the inspiration, to feel the presence, the power, the blessing of Jesus Christ in their life. So I present this to the navigators this morning to remind you that I was here sharing with you this morning, that I was on the moon in the summer of 71, but most importantly, that God was there. And I truly believe He was there because of the prayers of men and women, boys and girls on the earth. And I want to thank you again for your prayers. Lauren, will you accept this for the navs?
Yes, I will.
And I'll inscribe it okay. As soon as I have an opportunity, maybe during lunch.
Thank you very much. And would you, Jim, have a few minutes more just to tell us about some of your tours, your experiences, and a little about high flight?
I'd love to.
And I want to give my wife a buzz and see if she can't make it over here to lunch.
Okay, good. Lauren, I wish you'd give my wife a buzz and make sure she makes it, too. No, you know, I got back from the trip to the moon, and this message that I had wasn't an immediate thing. It took a while to reflect on what had happened to me, what I'd seen, and what I'd felt. So it was probably about 2 or 3 weeks before the thing had become crystal clear, what I wanted to share. And as soon as it had crystallized, as soon as I had something organized in my own mind, I started sharing it with churches down in the Texas area. Then we gradually moved out, visiting people all over the country, to the point where, you know, weekends became the busiest part of my week, Saturdays and Sundays. And almost always took my family with me so that they'd understand and so they'd feel part of this thing that had possessed me. And then when I had the opportunity to retire last summer, I knew that I needed help to allow me to travel, to direct my efforts, to tell me where I should go, because the requests were just overwhelming. You know, everyone wanted to hear from a man who'd been to the moon. They think he thought he might know something that they did not. And so it was a great responsibility. I had to tell them something. But, you know, to feel this message so strongly, I needed some organization to direct those efforts, and so High Flight Foundation was formed. My pastor, Bill Rittenhouse, who had been my pastor down in Houston, of course, felt so moved by the possibilities of this thing and my desires that he resigned from the church down in Houston to come up here and work with me with High Flight. Rocky came up from Houston. Several have come up, but we have just a very small office in Colorado Springs, but we're interested in really the same thing that y'all are, trying to reach out and reach people to tell them about Jesus Christ. And of course, my opportunities are great because I can combine science with religion and try to bring them back together, because there's so many people, you know, on the earth that are trying to create a division between science and religion. And I want to do everything that I can to bring them back together, to resolve any differences. Because in my mind, you know, science is really uncovering or discovering God's basic laws. Religion is just this personal relationship between man and God, and hopefully Jesus Christ. So there's no conflict there. The scientist needs this personal relationship as much as anyone else. And of course, religion needs science and technology. Because we use science and technology, of course, radio and television, to try to reach people, to go to places where man can't physically go. And so we need each other, really. As far as the activities that High Flight are involved with, why? Of course, I'm traveling all the time. My pastor's conducting revivals and speaking. We're doing writing. We're also interested in sponsoring this retreat for the POWs and their families this summer. So, I don't know. We're asking for the Lord's leadership in this one, because we know that these men and their loved ones need some time alone. They need a physical retreat and they need a spiritual retreat. Of course, I'm also very pleased to read the accounts that many of these men are coming back deeply spiritual. That in many cases, I think they're going to have more to give than to receive. So I think we'll be learning a great deal from these men. They've had their retreat. But those that need the help, I think they need the opportunity to move away from society and to really have spiritual guidance. To develop a strong spiritual relationship with God and Jesus Christ, with their families, to bring them back into a strong family unit. And so that's another activity that we're involved with right now. But we've got so many things going. But perhaps I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. I think I've treated the specific points that you asked for, Lauren. High Flight is, really just another outreach of the old story. But then, of course, told, in my case, by a man who's had this unique opportunity to move out and to see, really look back and see the earth, really with the eyes of God, and to realize His greatness, the majesty of God and the smallness of man. What can man do, to help other men? Man, it's a compelling task. Yes.
Sir, could you reflect on some of your experiences recently in Charleston, South Carolina, your reception there?
That's right. I didn't get a chance to talk about those trips. I wanted to wait until Lauren was back. Well, let's see. That was the week before last, I believe. We were down in Charleston, South Carolina at the Citadel on Sunday and Monday. I had a chance to share with all the cadets there at the Citadel on Monday. And the subject of the talk was greater issues. Was that it, Rocky? Greater issues. But I hope I shared with them one of the greatest issue. That was this concern of the spiritual nature of man, the need for every man and woman, boy and girl, to establish this personal relation with God. Of course, I had a chance to speak at the Citadel Square Baptist Church. That was a busy week, but it was typical of my travels, because we left the Citadel, we flew to, and Rocky was with me on this particular trip, flew to the School of the Ozarks at Point Lookout, Missouri, spent the evening there. The next morning, we went to the University of Alabama. Next day, we were over at Auburn University. Then the next day we flew back to Minden, Louisiana, where I had a chance to speak at a father-son wildlife banquet. And then we flew back to Alabama. I spoke at Jacksonville State in Jacksonville, Alabama. And then flew back late Saturday night. But it was a week of tremendous opportunities, to reach many, many young people, the college students on the campuses. I think I should share with you that I work part-time for Johns Manville. They consider me a management trainee. And in fact, I should share with you that I'm being trained in so many different fields. of course, the one of doing missionary work, you know, and understanding the scriptures is certainly one where I need a lot of training. And so I'm working with the navigators on that. But as far as Johns Manville and corporate relationships, I'm being trained there. I'm also being trained by the Radio and Television Commission of the Southern Baptists as a broadcaster. So I do a lot of radio and television work down there. But in my work with Johns Manville has been kind of a learning situation, also a sharing relation. And so when I do work with them, they usually arrange for a civic luncheon, like a Rotary Club. But they also, the most meaningful thing is the opportunity to speak to high schools. And they contact the high school and, you know, arrange a program where I can share for about an hour with the young people. And this has been really the most heartwarming experience, is to be able to share with the young people, because they're so responsive, they're so interested in science, and then here's an opportunity to share their spiritual development. But specifically down at Charleston, I did run into a few down there that were related to y'all. I think there were, and I'll give their names to Lauren. I have a long list of names of navigators that I've met, you know, around our country and overseas. One in London, Japan, many in Australia, in Sydney, Melbourne. Let's see, New Zealand. Yeah, everywhere. It was a little confusing. Sometimes I thought they were, you know, Air Force navigators. Sometimes they weren't. But finally I learned that there were no Air Force navigators. They were all the navs. Yes.
Certainly, sir, you face a lot of opposition in this work. And what kind of opposition do you face, and how can we pray in that area for you?
I need your prayers in several areas. One is just the strength, you know, to bear up under the schedule, because it is very demanding. The prayers that, you know, that my message stays fresh and vital, because that's my prayer, you know, each day, because you share with people, you know, the basic testimony over and over again. Sometimes, you know, it could get old and it could get stale. And I pray that it always stays fresh in my life. I need your prayers for my family, that they be understanding, because family life is a very short period of time anymore. You know, I get home maybe one day every 2 weeks. And so I don't have the opportunity to share with them. And I would like to reduce my travel load. Well, I'm going to have to, because right now we're expecting a fifth child, a little Vietnamese boy that we're adopting. In fact, he was supposed to have come in this last week. An Air Force chaplain was to bring him in. He was supposed to come in Thursday evening into San Francisco, into Travis. But we got a call from Saigon that no more military, we're leaving Vietnam, you know, until the exchange of prisoners was decided. So we got a call that little Joe wouldn't be coming for a while. And so now we're kind of on pins and needles. We know we're just waiting until we get another call as to when he'll be arriving. But we saw little Joe when we were over there last fall on our visit into Vietnam. But I also need your prayers that in my work with all of you, that I can learn the Bible the way I should. Because frankly, you know, before the flight, I went to church, tried to take the kids to Sunday school, but I wasn't active in the church. And now I find a great need, a great deal of learning there, a great deal of understanding that I must learn. Of course, I must share with you very briefly, you know, that opportunity to go to the Holy Land at Christmas time. That was really great, to be able to take Mary and the children with me and to be able to visit all these very historic sites over there, really to walk where Jesus walked. And, of course, that in itself just made the Scriptures come alive, because now I read the Scriptures and really I can put myself, you know, right there. It was the greatest experience. But I need your prayers in all of these areas. Believe me, you'll have my prayers. Another question? Yes.
I've heard that other astronauts that have been to the moon have also come back with a moving experience that has stimulated to do other things, scientific work. I'm wondering if you could explain what some lead men are doing now?
I always say that, you know, every man who's had the opportunity to go into space has been inspired spiritually, whether he's an astronaut or a cosmonaut. Of course, in the case of the Russians, they don't have the freedom to express themselves. I hope to get a chance, have a chance to share with them this summer, because we hope to be in Eastern Europe late summer and into Russia. And I hope to be able to share with them over there. But it's a very moving experience, you know, to move through space. And you feel God's presence. And many, they've all felt it. Many will talk freely about it. Others will not, you know. Others feel it, but they don't want to share it. And I think it's very similar to the Christian way of life, the Christian. Because many Christians, you know, they have it, but they're not sharing it. Sometimes it's a difference between individuals. But I know, for instance, Captain Ed Mitchell, who retired a little bit after I did, felt the very same thing I did on the surface of the moon, you know, this presence of God, what I've referred to the presence of God. He doesn't want to admit that it was God's presence. He's looking for a scientific explanation to what this was, this spiritual, this mental power that we'd never experienced before. And, of course, he's searching. Frankly, I don't think that, you know, this is something that there'll ever be a scientific answer to, because I think it's meant that you have to take it on faith. Some of the others, most of the others, you know, that have been to the moon are still in the program. There are not many who have retired. Buzz Aldrin retired, but he had a great deal of problem in adjusting to the demands of society. I guess he didn't feel anything that he wanted to share with people. You know, in my particular case, I felt the thing so have such a great effect on me, you know, that I welcome the opportunity to share with people. And so it just had the opposite effect on my life. But it's required a lot of prayer for guidance, sustenance. And really, I should share with you, you know, that before the flight, you know, I was and I still am, rather quiet, reserved, and really never spoke unless someone, you know, asked me a question. And then I was rather brief. Frankly, I didn't care for public speaking. It always kind of scared me. And I used to get nervous. My knees would shake when asked to make a speech and to have to get up and, I'd have to practice, you know, I'd have to practically memorize the speech. But the Lord has answered my prayers. He's in almost every instance, he's given me the right words to use. And that was so true in that visit to when we were in Jordan, you know, at Christmas time, because it was a command performance. I was over there with a choir performing the Messiah. But after the Messiah, I had a chance to give my personal testimony and show a movie of Apollo 15. And I was praying that God would give me the right words to use, you know, to give a strong Christian message in that environment, because here's the king and the queen and all the royal family, mostly Muslims there in the audience. Give me the right words to use in that situation. And he did. He came through. He answered my prayers, and I was able to give a strong witness of my belief in God and Jesus Christ. And I think the king was moved by it. I think he appreciated it. A strong stand on one's faith. Perhaps one more question, and then you control the schedule here, I'm sure, Lauren. You decide. Let's see, what trips. I might talk briefly about the trips this year, so you'll know where I'm going. We're going into Western Europe in May and June, Eastern Europe in July and August, and then into Africa in November. And each of these trips is about 1 month in duration, you know, trying to hit every country on that continent. And so it's rather a short exposure, you know, 3 days hopefully in each country. But of course you have to make maximum utilization of radio and television and as many rallies as you can work in. But it's going to be a busy schedule. Yes.
Did you get any cooperation from the DC and European governments?
Are we getting any cooperation? I don't know. We haven't pursued it in that detail. We haven't, pinned down to that detail what we'll be doing over there. It'd be very interesting to find out what opportunities will there be to speak to large groups of people. Will there be any opportunities? So I really need your prayers for that activity. Well, I need your prayers, wherever I go. Even in Colorado Springs.
Well, Jim, I think that one day perhaps the outstanding question I've heard ask you was asked by my daughter in the office that day. Remember, she asked, "Do you really eat space sticks up there?"
And what did I tell her?
And you said, "Yes, you do."
Yeah, in fact, that was our only lunch, while we were out on the surface of the moon during doing all those explorations, because we can't very well eat with that spacesuit on. So we did have a space stick that was just one space stick. What do they call them? Space sticks, I guess.
That's what we call
them. Fruit bars. Fruit bars. It was in our suit here, and we'd kind of reach down and grab it, bite off a chunk as we pulled it up. And that was our lunch. Are you serving space sticks today, Father?
I have to find out. Well, we appreciate very much your coming, and we'd like to join in prayer for you and your family right now. And I think we'll just ask all of you to stand. And Jim Downing, if you'd lead in prayer, please, for Jim Irwin and these requests he's made. And we'll all like to join and say amen in our hearts. I want to thank you before Jim Downing prays. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us. And we do pray for you, and we'll continue to do so. Jim.
Our Heavenly Father, we are grateful this morning for a new realization of your greatness. We rejoice in the testimony we've heard of your greatness, not only in space, but in personal lives. We thank you that your presence is close to us, that you are available wherever we are. And so we unitedly pray this morning for Jim and his family in this busy schedule that's ahead, that you will sustain them, that you will give physical protection, that you will continue to open unusual opportunities, that you will give to Jim the words and the message which will sow the seed of the message of Jesus Christ in many hearts, and that as a result of his testimony and message, that thousands and millions will be touched for Jesus Christ. These are the united prayers of our hearts, that you will sustain them, that you will meet their every need, and that you will do exceeding abundantly above all we are able to ask or think in their behalf. We pray these things in Jesus' name and for his glory.